Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The good news is there is a housing recovery going on in this country. The bad news is there is one major city that's getting left out. So what is the matter with Chicago? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson in for Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 26th of December. Great to have you with us. And we'll start with the good news. The numbers that came in this morning show a U.S. housing market that continues to pick up steam. According to the Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Index, home prices in 20 cities were up more than 4% on average in October compared with a year ago. But when you're talking averages, there are good performers and then there are bad performers. And in this case, the bad performer is Chicago, where prices are still falling. We asked Caroline O'Donovan from WBEZ in Chicago to find out why.
No Chicagoan likes to hear the word second city. But when it comes to real estate, Chicago has been vying to keep up with the rest of the country for years. Dennis Rodkin writes the deal estate column for Chicago Magazine. He says Chicago's number one problem is foreclosures and how long they can take under Illinois law.
What people refer to as the foreclosure free ride, the time between when you stop paying for your house and when you might be kicked out of your house, can be over 3 years at this point.
Illinois is not the only state where foreclosures get caught up in court, but Chicago's also dealing with its notorious winters.
A lot of these houses have sat through at least one, if not two or three winters. They may have water damage from burst pipes. They may have mold from water damage. So it's harder, more expensive to convert those low-price foreclosures.
Chicago's an aberration, says David Blitzer, the managing director and chairman of the group that publishes the Case-Shiller figures. He says Chicago wasn't hit as hard as one-industry towns like Detroit, nor did it have as far to fall as places
where real estate was a key industry and there was an incredible boom, and when it collapsed, it really collapsed. And that's the Sun Belt. I mean, Phoenix, Las Vegas, Miami, Tampa. Chicago doesn't fit into either of those molds.
Chicago's more like New York or Boston, an older city with a heavy dependence on its finance sector. But being in the Midwest, Chicago lacks the regional economic backbone of those cities. So it's recovering at a slower, more Midwestern pace. In Chicago, I'm Carolyn O'Donovan for Marketplace.
Christmas Eve was a bad night for Netflix. Just as millions of Americans were sitting down with their families, maybe thinking of putting on a movie, Netflix's online streaming service went down. The company is blaming Amazon, which owns the servers Netflix uses. Amazon, by the way, also runs a rival streaming video service. So what do you do when you're a company like Netflix that relies on a competitor to run your business? Here's Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff.
There's a name for this kind of relationship.
Yeah, co-opetition.
Co-opetition, as in cooperation and competition. Or you might say...
frenemies, that's another way to put it, yeah.
Ethan Kurzweil is vice president at venture capital firm Bessemer Venture Partners. He says we're seeing more and more corporate relationships that you might call complicated. Netflix CEO Reed Hastings derides Amazon's rival video streaming service, but he sings the praises of Amazon's web servers, at least until they knocked Netflix offline briefly this week.
It certainly makes for a great story.
Eric Clemens is a professor at the Wharton School. He says no one is suggesting this was malicious on Amazon's part, but it's another example of just how complicated the borders between companies have become. Apple, for one, still relies on Samsung for many of its chips, even as their smartphones duke it out. And Apple has been trying to distance itself from Google now that Android is the iPhone's fiercest rival.
Most people simply didn't understand what being dependent upon Google meant.
It's hard to predict when a friend might become a foe. Kurzweil of the venture capital firm says many startups get off the ground using Amazon servers or maybe selling through Amazon's site. That can be a boon or end badly.
The result is that Amazon knows a lot about their businesses and can always choose to compete.
And then coopetition becomes good old competition. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
There are now just about 5 days left until we go over the fiscal cliff of spending cuts and tax increases. CNBC has a countdown clock running, and just in case that wasn't enough to make you pay attention, there's this.
Do you agree that there could be financial or market Armageddon, or maybe not?
Maybe not. They're just asking questions. For his part, President Obama is heading back to Washington from his vacation in Hawaii tonight. And Congress, well, let's check in on C-SPAN.
Bad things have happened before, and bad things will happen again, unfortunately, in the future.
Oh, that sounds like maybe they are talking about the fiscal cliff. That's, of course, Senator John Kerry. Please continue, Senator.
There will always be a tension between the diplomatic imperative to get outside the wire and the security standards that require our diplomats to work behind high walls, concertina wire, and full-body searches.
Nope, that's definitely not about the fiscal cliff. And also, it's a rerun from last week. On Wall Street today, traders were thinking about the cliff. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Well, we've taken a little field trip outside now. We are at the LA Coliseum, which has been home in the past to the Olympics. It is where the USC Trojans play football. And today, it is the site of the City of Los Angeles Anonymous Gun Buyback Program. There are lines of cars that go all the way around the block and down the street with people who have come here to turn their guns in for a $100 gift card if they're turning in a handgun, a shotgun, or a rifle. Or if it's an assault weapon, they get a $200 gift card. So now let's go check in and see why some of them have come. So what have you brought back in today?
Shotgun.
A shotgun?
Yes.
And that'll get you $100, $100 gift card.
I think so. Like. I'm not anti-gun. I'm from a Texas family. My mom and dad always had a gun. Huh. So I'm not going to be gunless, so to speak. But I do think that there's no purpose for automatic gunfire in our cities and in our country. That is strictly a war weapon.
What have you brought back with you today here?
An Italian army rifle, a Carcano. It's famous for supposed to be the thing they shot Kennedy with.
Really?
Yeah.
So it was just, it was like sitting in the attic and brought it in.
Yeah.
And did the $100 or $200 gift card make a difference to you?
Yes.
So you wouldn't have done it if it hadn't been for that?
No, I don't even live in the area. I had to drive 40 miles to.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, just expediency. No, it's not about gun control.
Not about gun control for
no.
you. Do you have other weapons in addition to these?
Yeah. This has not removed all the guns from my household, no.
Well, what do you think about this program?
Truthfully, I don't think it's an effective way to get guns off the street.
So, what have you brought back in here today?
A rifle. What else? And a gun.
A rifle and a gun?
Yes.
And why did you decide to do that?
It was my brother's, and he just passed away. My mom doesn't want to sell it or anything. She'd rather just get rid of it just in case, you know. She'd rather it be gone, put away somewhere safe than to be put out in the streets.
So you just want to get it off the streets?
Yes.
Does the money make a difference? I mean, that you're going to get $100?
I mean, it's a help. It's a big help, and it is an encouragement. But at the same time, either way, my mom still was going to do that.
So that's why some people have come here. Another person who's here is the mayor of Los Angeles, Antonio Villaraigosa, and he has agreed to talk with us today. Mr. Mayor, welcome back to Marketplace.
Oh, it's great to be on Marketplace with you.
Well, so
happy holidays.
You too. So tell us what the point of this event is. What do you hope to get out of this?
Well, this is an opportunity for people to get involved. I think everybody was so traumatized by the Newtown shootings. People said, I don't want to wait on the Congress. I'm tired of the endless debates about responsible gun control legislation. I want to do my part, and this is an opportunity for people to do their part. We've been doing this on Mother's Day for a few years now, since 2009. Collected about 8,000 guns and assault weapons, and as I've said, even grenade launchers. This is, as you can see, I have never seen lines like the ones I've seen here today.
But are the really bad people going to bring their guns back? And are the good people going to bring all their guns back?
Well, one of the reasons why we know that many of these people are obviously law-abiding people who want to participate. Remember, those guns oftentimes are stolen from homes and then used in crimes. So this is one more assault weapon, one more gun that won't be used in a crime. Most importantly, we need to do a number of things. We need tougher gun laws, an assault weapons ban, a federal assault weapons ban. We need to have universal background checks at a time when 40% of the sales that occur are private sales that don't require a background check.
What do you make of the suggestion from the NRA that we put a cop with a gun in every school? I mean, you do have cops with guns in your high schools here in L.A.
Yes, we do, and we will be patrolling. We announced that before the NRA commercial or press conference, whatever it was, the one where they didn't take any questions. And there was a reason they didn't take questions, because the vast majority of people watched that and said, are you kidding me? What planet are these people from? We can have responsible gun control laws. We can do things that don't take away guns from law-abiding people, but do enforce our gun laws better, do close the loopholes that we have that are completely unacceptable. This is L.A.'s way, the people of L.A.'s way to say, I want to make a difference. I want to do something. I want to do my part. I want to get rid of guns I don't use. Get them away from my home.
And you think something like this will actually make a difference when it comes to the amount of guns that are out on the streets?
There's a reason the police department supports this effort. All these cops that are here because they want to get these guns off the streets. Look at these assault weapons right here. What do we need an assault weapon on the streets of L.A. for? The answer is we don't need them, and we got to do something about it.
Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, as you probably know, working in Silicon Valley has its perks. Free lunch, free massages, 20% time. That's the work time you can use to pursue independent projects. And this, a private bus that picks you up in your neighborhood in San Francisco and shuttles you down to your corporate campus in Silicon Valley. Sounds pretty good if you ask me, but apparently some people aren't so happy about it, as Marketplace's Queena Kim reports.
During rush hour in San Francisco, you see them everywhere.
They're just so big. These buses are two stories high, and they're barreling through residential streets. And no one knows where they're going except the people who are on them.
Eric Rodenbach is a creative director of Stamen Design in the Mission District of San Francisco. And he's talking about the private shuttle buses that run up and down the peninsula. They look like fancy tour buses. Google's are white, Facebook's are sleek blue. But beyond that, there's sort of a mystery to most San Franciscans.
You know, it's almost like this Masonic ritual. If you've got the key, this whole other city layer unlocks itself to you. And that's a kind of urban puzzle that we like to solve.
So Stamen decided to map the private shuttle buses connecting San Francisco to Silicon Valley. But getting the data wasn't easy. The tech companies don't comment on the buses. They don't tell you where they stop or how many people ride them. But in the era of big data, the information was easy enough to find.
Even though the companies may not have wanted to have the locations public, we started taking a look around and we realized that on Foursquare, if you typed in shuttle and Google or shuttle and Apple, all these locations came up because their employees were checking in at those bus stops. We hired some bike messengers to follow the buses around and to count people that got on and off of them. And some of it we just sat at a cafe on the corner of 18th and Dolores and counted the people getting off and on those buses.
I checked out the Google bus stop a little after 7 a.m. one rainy morning. And the G-Bus, as the display in the windshield reads, was already picking up Googlers. For the next few hours, the buses would arrive in 15 to 20-minute intervals, and a steady stream of 20 and 30-somethings holding coffee cups, wearing sneakers and backpacks would get on board.
Hey, I'm a reporter from Marketplace. I was wondering if I could ask you guys a couple questions.
I'm a pass.
We're on the quiet period.
Oh, a quiet period? Oh, even about the bus.
A quiet period is when a company can't say anything that might affect its stock price. And that was the nicest response I got until I met 35-year-old Tanya Birch, who works on Google Earth's outreach team.
What's it like inside there?
It's pretty sweet. They let us choose the type of seats and the decor inside, and it's got dim lighting with the Google colors.
And can you guys get work done?
Yeah, there's free Wi-Fi provided on the shuttles, and it's another hour of work.
The tech world is driven by young, educated workers. But companies like Facebook, Google, and Apple are located in the suburbs in Silicon Valley, which is about an hour south of the city.
I think a lot of young people that work at these tech companies, they want the city life, something that's entertaining, and you don't get that in the suburbs.
And so to compete for that talent pool, big tech companies have to provide transportation. Roddenbeck says he expected to find shuttles in the city's hip young neighborhoods.
What we were surprised to learn is that the network is much more extensive than that.
When the map was finished, Stamen counted buses from Apple, eBay, Electronic Arts, Facebook, Google, and Yahoo. And they found the buses ran through almost every neighborhood in San Francisco. In all, Stamen estimates that about 14,000 people ride the private shuttle buses every day. And why are these locations secret?
I think that the companies are kind of sensitive to this idea that they are funding a change in the infrastructure of San Francisco without it being regulated.
The San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency is in the midst of studying what's essentially emerging as a private mass transportation system. Jerry Robbins is a transportation planner for the agency.
The increase in employer buses has sparked some reaction from residents.
He says that since tech companies contract out the work to private bus companies regulated by the state, the city has little say in what they do. But Robbins says the agency has fielded complaints that the private shuttle buses, which often stop at public bus stops, are causing delays and traffic. Another impact, rising real estate prices.
Unquestionably, the shuttle stops are transforming real estate values.
Amanda Jones has been a realtor in San Francisco for nearly a decade. Today, about half her clients work in the tech industry.
When I interview new clients, we get out the real estate map and they want to show me where their corporate shuttles are. I recently sold a home. He does trading for Google and gets in early in the morning. Literally, if it wasn't within 5 blocks of a shuttle stop, we didn't look at it.
And Jones says even fixer-uppers and homes with shaky foundations sell for a premium if they're located near a private shuttle bus stop.
They have so little time to have with their family and their friends that they want to go home and be able to walk to the restaurant and not be stuck in their car for 2 hours.
And Jones says she gets it. Until they come up with an app that can beam you to work, the private shuttle bus is as close as you get. I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up, the Freakonomics team joins us to talk about bosses and the difference they can make in boosting productivity.
They found that a good boss matters quite a bit, more than they would have thought.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street had a hangover today from a disappointing shopping season. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dipped 24 points, or just under 0.2%, to close at 13,114. The NASDAQ handed back 22 points, 0.75%, finished below 3,000 at 2,990. The S&P 500 fell 6 points, about 0.5%, to close at 1,419. Retail stocks dragged the market down. Handbag and leather accessory maker Coach sank nearly 6%. Clothing chain Abercrombie & Fitch unraveled 3.5%. Amazon shed nearly 4% 2 days after that server outage we told you about earlier. Netflix, on the other hand, picked up 0.5%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home sales for November. Christmas is over, but your tree may still be up. Is it fake? Then it's probably from China. That country shipped $139 million worth of artificial Christmas trees to the U.S. between January and September of this year. And 80 years ago, Radio City Music Hall kicked open its doors in New York City. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Jeremy Hobson. We just talked with the mayor of Los Angeles about gun control and the steps he's taking to get guns off the streets of L.A. But no matter how successful that effort is, there will still be way more guns here in the U.S. than there are in Europe. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now on the very different standard for gun control across the pond.
Britain has the tightest gun control in Europe, largely due to two rampage killings. After one of them in 1987, semi-automatic and pump-action shotguns were banned. And then, 10 years later, handguns were also outlawed after the Dunblane school shootings. Criminologist Peter Squires.
The shooting of 16 children was so appalling. It galvanised a real national reaction. There was a profound sense that we didn't want to go down the American gun culture pathway.
So much so that in many parts of the UK, a police officer will visit your home and inspect your gun cabinet before you get a licence. Spree killings have triggered a tightening of gun laws in other European countries. But then it's easier to do that here than in the US. Keith Krause of the Small Arms Survey in Geneva says Europeans don't have a constitutional right to bear arms. Far from it.
All throughout Europe, gun ownership is treated as a privilege and not a right, and you have to demonstrate and justify your need or desire to have a weapon.
As a result, gun ownership is much lower in Europe. For example, the US has 88 registered firearms for every 100 people. Britain has just 6. But the legal availability of guns doesn't automatically equal crime. Switzerland has an average number of gun homicides, and yet under the country's reservist defence system, there are millions of military weapons kept at home. Gun control expert Owen Green.
You have a very interesting phenomenon that nearly all Swiss males have guns, but they criminal Swiss would never dream of using their military weapons because that would be unpatriotic. They would tend to go to the illegal market.
And no one pretends that gun control can prevent all rampage killing. The worst civilian gun massacre in recent years, in which 69 people died, happened in Norway, which, next to Britain, has the strictest gun restrictions in Europe. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
And now it's Freakonomics time. Every 2 weeks, we talk with Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and blog about the hidden side of everything. Stephen, it's good to have you back.
Hey, thank you, Jeremy. I would like to talk to you today, if I may, about bosses and how much they actually matter.
All right, bosses. How much do they matter?
Well, here's the thing. We know that a bad boss is a drag, but in terms of how good a good boss can be and how that translates into productivity, it sounds like an easy question, but it's not. It takes an economist to dig into it. Here's Stanford economist Ed Lazier.
Suppose you look at a firm and you see that the firm is highly productive. Well, it may be highly productive because it has productive workers, because it has productive technology, or because it has good supervisors that are enhancing the productivity of the workers. And it's not so easy to tease out one effect from another.
So it's a bit of a cause and effect riddle that you want to solve. The challenge here is to find some data that allows you to isolate and then measure the effect of the boss.
All right. So I'm waiting for the big answer here, Stephen. What is the data? What did they find?
Well, first of all, the data they got was from a huge service company, which Lazier and his colleagues aren't allowed to name because of the academic research agreement. But this company does a lot of different things, everything from running call centers to processing insurance claims. And the data that the researchers got was extremely granular. They could really see individual transactions for more than 23,000 employees and 2,000 bosses. Now, Jeremy,
wow.
Here's the best part. In this company, the typical employee switches bosses a few times a year, depending on which project they're working on. So it makes it possible to chart the impact of a given boss, okay? Here is Catherine Shaw, who is Lazier's entrepreneurial co-author. She is also an economist at Stanford.
This data, because it is computerized data and we're just looking at the effects of workers moving between bosses, it's very difficult to screw that up.
Okay, so we've got good data here, Stephen. We've got a lot of data, thousands of people. What did they find?
They found that a good boss matters quite a bit, more than they would have thought. The researchers argue that the better bosses at this company increased productivity for a given worker by about 10%. Here's Ed Lazier again.
I mean, a 10% effect is a pretty big deal, especially when the way that the boss is doing this is indirect in the sense that the boss in this context is not actually producing herself. What she's doing is she's actually helping the subordinate be more productive.
And can you take this data, Stephen, outside of the workplace setting with your boss-employee relationship and apply it to leadership in general?
Well, Jeremy, we've tried in the past to measure the effect and the influence of different top-level leaders, CEOs, baseball managers, even the president of the United States. And what you generally find, the data tell us, that their influence is actually much smaller than people generally would imagine. Now, why bosses have a bigger effect, it's hard to say. We don't know. It may be just because bosses have more influence on an employee's life than a CEO does or a president does, for instance. For what it's worth, Lazier and Shaw, both these economists, have worked for presidents as economic advisors, Shaw for Clinton and Lazier for the second George Bush. Lazier says that Bush was a pretty good boss.
He wanted to hear directly from us and hear what we had to say. His view was that was both more effective in terms of communication, but also more effective in terms of motivation.
Well, so for those bosses that are listening out there and want to emulate that, what can they do? Is there any advice from all you've learned?
Well, I wish there was a magic answer of some kind. We did ask readers on freakonomics.com, bosses, to tell us what they have done that worked. We heard one that's worth sharing. This is from a fellow named Jim Helton, who runs an employee benefits company. He argues that a little bit of humility and humor can go a long way.
So what we had is a dumbass award. We put it on your desk and you owned it.
So, Jeremy, there you go. One way to be a better boss, just pass out the occasional dumbass award, and apparently everybody's happy.
We need to start doing that at Marketplace. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics Radio. He also puts out a podcast, which you can get on iTunes and hear more at freakonomics.com. Stephen, we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Thanks so much, Jeremy.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today about Starbucks, which is asking its employees in the Washington, D.C. area to write the words "come together" on people's coffee cups, hoping that a message like that can maybe influence the fiscal cliff negotiations. Or to put it in Starbucks speak, hopefully Congress can move past this drip, 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 focus on all Americanos, and reach a grande bargain. It's a tall order, I know. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the program for us. I'm Jeremy Hobson. See you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.